The expansion of the monastic network. The very fact that Pope Eugenius III called upon Bernard of Clairvaux to preach the Second Crusade hints at another major 12th century development. Bernard was a monk, and thus was supposed to have withdrawn from the world to live a secluded life of contemplation. Yet here we see him, travelling far and wide, meeting kings and preaching to huge crowds. Moreover, wherever he went, his reputation preceded him. When a controversy over the election of the Pope broke out in 1130, Bernard was asked to decide which candidate should be nominated. He chose Innocent II, and then travelled around Europe for several years trying to persuade the rulers who had supported the other candidate to switch sides. In 1145, the principal reason for Eugenius being elected Pope was that he was a friend of Bernard. Bernard's influence and reputation also gave a huge impetus to his religious order. Thousands of people now flocked to join the Cistercian order, which had been founded in 1098, and whose monks vowed to lead an austere life strictly governed by the rule of St. Benedict. By 1152, the order had more than 330 monasteries spread across Europe, and in the second half of the century it expanded further into Eastern Europe, Scotland, and Ireland. By the end of the century, it had also added several dozen nunneries. The Cistercians were not the only monastic order on the rise. The Carthusians opted for an even more austere existence, living in cells around the cloisters of their charterhouses. There were also several orders of religious clerics, such as the orders of Canons Regular, the Augustinians, whose lifestyle closely resembled that of monks. William of Champeaux established the order of the Canons of St. Victor, the Victorines, in 1108. Bernard's friend, Norbert of Chantenne, founded the Premonstrantensian order in 1120, and Gilbert of Sempringham set up the Gilbertines in 1148. When combined with crusading zeal, the monastic spirit led to a similar growth in the military orders, whose duties included prayer and the protection of pilgrims. The Knights Hospitaller developed in the wake of the success of the First Crusade. The Order of Knights Templar, founded in 1118, was enthusiastically supported by Bernard of Clairvaux. In Castile in the 1150s, the Cistercians set up their own military wing, the Order of Calatrava, and the Teutonic Knights were established towards the end of the century. These were just the most notable orders. Many more flourished to protect pilgrims to the Holy Land. The scale of monasticism's expansion becomes clear if we look at the figures for England and Wales. In 1100, there had been fewer than 148 religious houses, including some 15 nunneries. Over the course of just two decades, 1135 to 54, the number rose from about 193 to 307, an increase of 6 every year. In 1216, there were about 700 religious houses, with another 60 to 70 belonging to the Hospitallers and Templars. The number of monks, canons, and nuns increased to an even greater extent, from about 2,000 to about 12,000. If we were to extrapolate totals for the whole of Europe from these figures, there would have been 8,000 to 10,000 religious houses in Western Christendom at the end of the 12th century, and about 200,000 monks, nuns, and canons. However, when we take into account that England and Wales were relatively sparsely populated fringes of Christendom at this time, it becomes apparent that the actual numbers of religious men, women, and houses in 1200 were much higher. Why did this happen? What made people give away huge amounts of their wealth to support these new religious houses? To understand their motivation, we need to examine the rise of the doctrine of purgatory, the Roman Catholic belief that the souls of the dead do not go straight to heaven or hell, but rather to a spiritual holding bay, where they remain for a while before being sent in one direction or the other. Before this doctrine developed, those lords and ladies who founded monasteries did so in the hope that, as a result of their good works, their souls might ascend straight to heaven when they died. If they didn't, they would be spending the rest of eternity in hell. Around the middle of the 12th century, however, the question of whether your soul went to heaven or hell became more nuanced. At what point exactly was the soul condemned to hell? Did this occur at the moment of death, or might prayers for the dead still assist the passage to heaven? Theologians elaborated on the ancient idea of redemption through prayer, and conveniently decided that prayers after death could indeed help the deceased. In the 1150s, Peter Lombard declared that prayer could help both the moderately wicked, by lessening their suffering, and the reasonably good, by aiding their path to paradise. People started to believe that such souls did not go straight to heaven or hell. By 1200, an elaborate doctrine of purgatory had been established, and more people donated their wealth to monasteries and chantry chapels, hoping that prayers said for them after death might hasten their passage to eternal bliss. You might be tempted to think that, as all these new monks and nuns were shut away in cloistered communities, they hardly affected what was going on outside. So how could they mark a huge development in the history of the Western world? We need to consider the 12th century in terms of connectedness, however. Today, in our web-wondrous world of intercommunication, we believe that our methods of obtaining information and passing on our views are completely different from those of our forebears. Networks of information storage and transfer now exist that previous generations could not even have imagined. Monasticism, however, provided a similar connectedness. It was a layer of Christian interconnectivity, a monastic web, interwoven with the secular world of parish priests, court clerks, and political bishops. From Iceland to Portugal, from Poland to Jerusalem, monks, canons, and priests were crossing the boundaries of kingdoms, spreading knowledge, and taking part in wider debates. Capitalizing on the Latin orthodoxy introduced by Pope Gregory VII in the previous century, they did so in a common language that rendered itself internationally useful, in the same way that the standard markup languages underpin the Internet today. This Christendom-wide monastic web did not just spread knowledge, it was able to generate it too. Just think of all the roles that a monastery fulfilled. Building work required master masons, carvers, and carpenters, so the monastic orders were major patrons of 12th century design and architecture, structural engineering, and art. Monasteries required monks and canons to be able to read, so they spread literacy. Several founded schools for the education of boys, and occasionally girls, outside the cloister, either as part of their good works or in order to raise money. In their libraries, they preserved the works of earlier writers and produced new books, thus storing as well as disseminating information. The monastery of Bec in Normandy, for example, had a library of 164 books in the early 12th century and acquired 113 more as the result of a bequest in 1164. It also opened a school for fee-paying students. In describing it, the chronicler Ordericus wrote that almost every monk of Bec seemed a philosopher, and even the least learned there had something to teach the frothy grammarians. When a monastery formed part of a cathedral establishment, as was common, the monks dealt with correspondence from the royal administration, which facilitated the creation of archives and the writing of chronicles. The monks themselves travelled, carrying news between monasteries across Europe. In their gardens, they cultivated medicinal plants, and those monasteries that had an infirmary performed a moderate degree of physic. Some orders circulated their technologies across the continent, spreading the use of the water wheel, the heavy plough, and better viticulture, and thus assisting with the exploitation of the newly cleared land. Not every monastery in Europe had a library full of wonderful texts, of course, and not every monastery had a school, but many had both. A monastery without a library is like a castle without an armoury, ran a saying at the time. Monasteries opened eyes, instructed minds, and encouraged the young who attended their schools to seek further knowledge, not just in their own monastic libraries, but also further afield.